This meeting of the House Fisheries Committee will come to order at 10:06. Welcome, everybody. Please turn off your telephones. Today is Tuesday, March 10th, 2015. Member present, Representative Ortiz, Representative Millett, and myself, Chair Stutes. We are also joined by Kelly Burnett from House Records, Jessica Hanlon from the LIO, and of course my committee aide, Reed Harris. Thank you, Reed. Thank you, everyone. Welcome. Today we're going to have a presentation by the Board of Fisheries. Glenn Height will be presenting. Please come forward. I guess I better put it on the record. There we go. Great. Thank you. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning. My name is Glenn Height, and I serve as the Executive Director with the Alaska Board of Fisheries and also as lead with the Board Support Section. We've got in the section, we have, of course, the Board of Game and also the 80-plus advisory committees for the Department of Fish and Game. Excuse me here while I organize a bit. So, Madam Chair, I've got an outline here, a presentation on the Board of Fish. I thought I would run through the slides and speak to the issues in general. I trust if you have questions, you'll stop me along the way. And
we certainly will.
And I don't know if it's appropriate to say if there's anything in particular that you would like me to make sure I cover. Right now, I could jot that down and make sure I hit it an appropriate time. Otherwise, I'll just field questions as they come. So.
Why don't we just take them as we come?
Right, great. Okay, the general outline for presentation is to discuss the purpose and composition of the board, take a look at the board process in general, and look at how the public and agencies provide input and influence those board decisions, and then just take a quick look at some of the laws that impact and affect the board and their work. So this is fairly simplistic here. Look at the three boards we actually have in board support. I'll cover Board of Fisheries here almost exclusively, but I thought I would open with a quick shot at the Board of Game, and then there's the Board of Fisheries and also the Joint Board, which is the two boards that come together. Of course, with the Boards of Game and Board of Fisheries, their main purpose is the conservation and development of game and fisheries resources. And conservation is defined as controlled utilization of a resource to prevent its exploitation, destruction, or neglect. And development is defined as management of a resource to make it available for use. So pretty simple, and then, of course, things get very complicated thereafter. The joint board is, again, the two boards that come together. There's lots of areas in statute that call for joint board action. It includes defining subsistence areas and non-subsistence areas. They also create the rules of the road for the advisory committees and for their own regulatory process. So this is a picture of actually the joint board from last year, and this includes, of course, Board of Fisheries members and the current six that we have. The board finds its authority in Alaska Statute 1605-221. The next two slides are just a bullet list of the duties defined for the boards in statute. I won't go through these. If any catch your eye, I'll try to answer to them. What I tell people in general when we talk about the Board of Fish and what they do, I just say they really are there to set regulations for who, what, where, when, and how fisheries resources is caught and used, and so they really cover everything related to, of course, fisheries management. This is the second page. Again, it's just a list of their duties. A little bit about board composition. It's a seven-member board appointed by the governor, confirmed by the full legislature. And the language that we have here on the screen is what's in statute: interest in public affairs, good judgment, knowledge, and ability in the field of action, and of course looking for a diversity of interests and points of view in its membership. What's also in statute is that they're to be appointed without regard to political affiliation or geographic location of residence. The current six members we have, Tom Kluberden from Talkeetna is our chair, John Jensen, vice chair from Petersburg, Orville Huntington from Hoosthia, Sue Jeffrey from Kodiak, Reed Mariski from Fairbanks, and Fritz Johnson from Dillingham. So a little bit about board process. You hear a lot that it's unlike any other regulatory process, certainly the case from my experience. We hear that it's publicly driven, and that is the case. You've got boards that are composed of people from the public. They treat the separation between themselves and the department very seriously. It's a professional relationship, but there is a distance to it. And of course, most of the things they act on are coming from the public. Well, I've got some stats on that that show one year's distribution of proposals that come from the public.
Thank you. I'd like to take a moment to recognize Representative Herron.
Thank you.
Morning. And so, what I find typically in an agency when it does regulations, it's driving those regulations. It finds a reason, whether it's trying to implement statute or there's some question that needs to be answered, and the agency goes about doing that. Here in the board process, it's entirely different. I'll explain the process a bit more, but it is by and large coming from the public, so it's very interesting and to see the kinds of things that come through.
Excuse me. Representative Mallett.
So I have a question. Here in the call for proposals, I think there's a piece of legislation floating around the building, and I haven't read it yet, but it's under the understanding that board proposals can come day of the board meetings. Have you taken a look at that?
Yeah, thank you. Through the chair, Representative Mallett. We're talking about board generated proposals in that regard, and we speak to them right now if you'd like. It's House Bill 103 was looking to do board generated proposals. Oh, thank you. Yeah, but the board will create its own proposals. It can do it as part of the normal cycle. It can do it during the cycle, but still within the regulatory framework. So if it's something that's not on subject at that meeting and hasn't been properly noticed, it'll go through a 30-day time period. And so we'd go out with a new notice if they were to do that. And I can give you some examples of that. And sometimes they will do a board generated proposal at a particular meeting if it's something that's been properly noticed at that meeting. But it's not too terribly common. We just got done with the Southeast Finfish meeting. And they did a board generated proposal because we had in regulation, there was a site for the Cake Hatchery, and it was formerly named, and that hatchery is no longer in business. And so the proposal was to simply write hatchery operated so that you could still function within the regulation. So in that regard, it was very, very technical. The board of fisheries has also done two others this year that are not in the regular cycle, so they've created the proposal, and it'll be deliberated on after 30-day notice. One of them is dealing with the Kuskokwim and some slight changes for subsistence management. Another one is setting escapement goals for Bristol Bay. So both of those are part of long-term efforts, and so they're accumulating to this point.
Follow-up?
Yes, please.
So my question would be then, so how do you see that in conjunction with advisory committees and them putting forward proposals? Do you see any betterment of that process? The advisory committees, I think, are feeling at this point in time that they are not being heard. I have some pretty vocal advisory committee members in my district that on a daily basis I get examples of the board either trumping their powers, ignoring their powers, or basically doing whatever the board wants to do without any input from the public. So the transparency part is what their issue is that the board is doing things behind closed doors, coming up with a proposal, and then not vetting it through the advisory committees. I mean, their point is if we're not going to have a good process, then let's just get rid of the advisory committees and the board can just come up with whatever the board wants to do, because that's kind of the feeling they get. So maybe you could help me understand how that process is working and then mm-hmm. how it would work under HB 103.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. Through the chair, Representative Millett. Advisory committees, we do hear frustration from them, and understandable. They put in a lot of time, a lot of volunteer work into what they do, and so they're really a critical part of this. I don't see any behind closed doors discussions that go on by the board. The two examples that I cited related to the Kuskokwim and related to setting escapement goals in Bristol Bay. Those are part of fairly public longstanding efforts. The one in Bristol Bay has been recognized as going on since 2012. The groups have gotten together with the department to help create the framework for that, and it was recognized that that would be the goal would be to implement that this year in 2015. If we were not in a meeting cycle that would allow for that, and so that they've brought in a board general proposal in order to consider that for the salmon season. With the Kuskokwim, it was part of the board created a Kuskokwim Subsistence Salmon Work Group, which includes advisory committee members. So they're part of that. So those are two efforts, fairly formalized, that are creating some proposals. And I can't speak to that the boards are getting behind closed doors. I don't see that happening. Advisory committees provide a number of proposals, and they go through the same process that public proposals go through, groups and associations go through. I will say, though, the advisory committees are highly regarded for the input they provide. But an example of how that can be difficult for the boards to deal with in looking at Upper Cook Inlet, for instance, we had really eight advisory committees, ranging from the Matsu down to Homer, providing input. And if you look at the proposals that they were most interested in, oftentimes there was a 4-4 split on their opinions about a proposal. So where one advisory committee might say they didn't listen to anything I said, the other advisory committee might say that they followed our instructions. So it's very dynamic. I guess I would just say that.
Excuse me. Before your follow-up, I'd just like to recognize Representative Culver, who just came in. Please, follow up.
So can you kind of give me a little background? I think we had three advisory committee members leave after got frustrated and just quit on us. I mean, that's highly unusual to have a group of people that solidified that just, I mean, that have spent 20-plus years in an advisory committee, and then for them just to walk out. Did you guys, I mean, had any communication with them? Have you talked to them on what the problems were? Have you taken any of their thoughts or, you know, what they went through into consideration on how you deal with advisory committees? I mean, it was real frustrating for me. I mean, I had, you know, conversations with them, you know, ad nauseum about, you know, what was going on, and they're very disgruntled, and I mean, they're to the point where I had a guy call me yesterday and tell me that he would rather have the federal government manage our fish and game boards rather than have the state do it through the board process. So, you know, have you talked to those gentlemen?
Through the chair, Representative Millett. I haven't talked to this individual that you speak of that I. We received the information that came from the advisory committee, from the Anchorage Advisory Committee, when you had several members resign over the summer. It was regrettable. I think they were frustrated with a number of things, but I can't speak to specifics. I know that that they didn't feel that the board was listening to them to some degree. I think that they were frustrated with the department in various levels, but and they were some long-standing members as well. So it's a very dynamic process. The what typically happens is that the department will work with these advisory committees and provide as much support as they can. I can't speak to what was going on inside with the Anchorage advisory committee, but
if someone could get back to me on that, I'd appreciate it, because it's really unusual to have that. I mean, they were 20-year advisory committee members, and to have them leave, that breadth of knowledge and that involvement and that dedication, and to be just that you can't speak to it, is a little frustrating for me right now. So I'd love for someone to get back to me on those issues.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome, Representative Foster. Mm-hmm. Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Haight, question for you. If the legislator were to adopt House Bill 103 and the governor signed it, would you see that as would it prevent the Fish Board from being able to take action? Like, for example, you mentioned your recent meeting. Would it be safe to say that there are certain things that certain times when the Fish Board needs to be able to take action, irrespective of, or not to ignore, but you need to take action on stuff that you might not even hear of from these different boards. Is that true?
Yeah. Yes. Through the chair. I represent Ortiz. Yeah, the Board of Fish has a number of mechanisms to bring proposals in out of cycle, but not all of them are always met. I'll speak to those a little bit as we go through, but not all those are always available, and so they do find the need to bring proposals forward, and so I referenced a couple of examples of that. You know, in the past, the board has produced some board agenda proposals that caused controversy, and they were concerned about that, and took that to heart and created a criteria for what they have to follow to bring proposals forward. I can get you a copy of that if you'd like, and that was adopted by the joint board, and so both boards will follow that when they bring proposals forward. In terms of the House Bill 103, yes, it would limit the board's ability to react to certain things and certain issues. One thing also that's a little uncertain for us is whether or not it impacts and influences the board's ability to provide substitute language for proposals, which is a very standard practice. So you get a proposal at a meeting, and sometimes it'll be conceptual. It won't be in regulatory language. And so as the board works on it and it gathers some strength from the public and from the department from the board, they'll actually put it into regulatory language so that it's easy to understand the intents captured. We're not certain if something like that would not be allowed under this, because the board is actually bringing that new language forward, even though, you know, in terms of the board speak, that's not a board-generated proposal. It's a proposal that's come from the public or from another source that they're reacting to. So there's uncertainty to it. I think it does eliminate a tool, the toolbox, for anyone who's coming onto the board, even people that might be disgruntled now once they get there and they're not allowed to create proposals to address issues. It might be a limiting issue for them.
Follow up?
And it looks like the goals of the board is to reflect a diverse group of people from diverse interest groups. So therefore, can we assume then that that a diverse group of interests groups do have their voices heard through the board itself? Is that a fair assessment?
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Ortiz. Yes, it is. My experience is limited to the last 2 years and limited to the board that I work with. But they come from different backgrounds. They have different perspectives and different values. But they do work hard to provide balance and consensus even with their differences. But there's always going to be outcomes that are difficult for some. I think in terms of House Bill 103 or any kind of change that is recommended for the board process, which I think is good to examine all the time, you have to recognize is the issue or the problem about the process or is it about the outcome of a debate or an outcome of an action? You've got to kind of ferret through that and see what's really causing the problem, because there'll always be controversy and question over the board's outcome on a decision, because it's an allocation and it's difficult. So I'm just some
in relation to Representative Ortiz's question, I guess the first thing that crossed my mind is when you say that the board then has the ability to put it in the appropriate language, is a situation occurring possibly of when they are putting it in that appropriate language, they're changing the meaning of the intent of what the board had proposed?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Typically not. They work hard not to do a 180, if you will, on what a proposal is asking. So that's something where, we sit at the table. We've got our the advisors there, including the Department of Law, which is pretty dogged on things like that. So they're not to change the intent of a proposal. What happens is that you sort of getting into the presentation, but you'll get a lot of public input before the meetings. And during the meetings, and that to some degree will shape and impact how the proposal is changed. You know, there's some things very simple, but maybe not, the proposer might not have been aware of it, will come up in public participation and promote a change. But they won't do 180 changes.
Representative Millett.
How many advisory committees do you have?
Through the chair, Representative Millett. We have 84. Not all are active.
How many people sit on those 84 advisory committees?
We have, last count, upwards of 900. So it's a massive volunteer effort across the state. I can cover that in a slide coming up, though.
Representative Herron.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just returning to the chairwoman's comment about changes, and then you said 180. The issue that I think that we're trying to get is that when you throw a ball and you're able to affect spin on it, you don't see the spin immediately. And so I think that's what the concern is. It's by the time you get to the destination, it has veered off course, but it doesn't appear to be. But that's not my question. That was just an observation. And maybe you'll cover this, is the boards are under Open Meetings Act, right?
That is correct. The future.
And so just for clarification, because maybe something was erroneously said at a previous meeting, is that three board members and staff went behind closed doors.
Through the chair, Representative Herron, I think, I've talked to our executive director, Christy Tibbles, with the Board of Game about this. I think it was a Board of Game issue. And it was, if I have this correct, it was a meeting that was called by a user group. It was held at the department, and one board member was there.
Mm-hmm. Okay, not three.
No. You have two, up to two.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just clarification.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So I'll continue on here. So as we go through this, I'll touch on the proposal process. And then get into the public review and comment periods, take a quick look at what a regulatory meeting looks like, and then, of course, how it's implemented. So this is a hard-to-read picture of the current proposal form. It's pretty simple, but every year the board will issue its call for proposals. It basically says to the state, we're going to be dealing with the following areas and the following species. Please give us what you have. You know, what are the problems out there and what would you like addressed? And those come to the department April 10th of every year, and we get upwards of 300 to 400 proposals a year. This year we had 278. So these proposals can be seeking fairly large-scale change. They can be technical. It just depends what folks are seeing out there. I thought it would be helpful to get a little snapshot of the nature of the proposers that we get. So this is just from last year. It does change to some degree, and of course, however I cast it in my spreadsheet sort of dictates how the pie falls out, so it could be done differently. But you can see that by and large, a lot of the proposals are coming from individuals. There are those proposals from advisory committees. The department will always submit proposals. Those tend to be fairly technical in nature. Seeking perhaps better descriptions on boundary changes. So maybe they're going to seek a change to provide better information for management purposes. They tend to be fairly conservative in their approach on these proposals. We'll also get them from businesses, groups, associations, tribal organizations. In last year, there was a board generated proposal that was put together. So it's just a snapshot of the kinds of people that are reaching out to the board through these proposals. Bit of a busy slide here. I'll just show you the first line, and the rest hopefully will make sense. The Board of Fisheries operates on a three-year meeting cycle, so it basically takes up regions on a three-year basis. This year, 2014-2015, we've tackled Prince William Sound finfish, southeastern Yakutat finfish, and crab. We'll be looking at statewide dungeness and other shellfish next week, and that's this year. And then they'll do it 3 years from now and three years later. And so you can see that this is the way they've broken it up. They started doing this in the early 90s. I looked at one report back in the 80s. The one year they had 800 proposals, and they were tackling all regions of the state, and it just was unwieldy. So that they've created this over the years. Next slide shows a day in the life of a typical board meeting. You'll have introductions at first with ethics disclosures. The department will deliver some staff reports, and then we'll go in the public testimony period. Individuals are given anywhere from 3 to 5 minutes to speak their mind. Advisory committees and representatives from regional advisory councils are given 10 to 15 minutes. And so that this is a typical public testimony time. And then what the board will do is go into committees. They'll break up their subjects based on subject areas. They may take three board members in one room and three board members in another, and then bring in all the stakeholders and interest groups for those particular issues, and they'll go down the list proposal by proposal and talk to people about those. And it's beyond public testimony. It's a great way to really delve into the issues and see what people are thinking. What they've been doing more recently is what I have in the acronym, apologies, it's Committee of the Whole, and that's where the whole board sits and listens to everyone. They'll go proposal by proposal, and they'll just vet it through the audience. And then the board will move into deliberations, and to the extent that they pass anything, that will become regulation. And then there's always an administrative miscellaneous business at the end of each meeting. Board receives tremendous amount of input from a number of different areas. This is just a list of some of those. Perhaps what I could have added here was the timing of input. So they set their meeting schedule, the Board of Fisheries does, 2 years in advance. They have the proposals are bound by the department. We put those out in August. They go out to the public. And for each meeting, there is a two-week deadline for what we call on-time public comment. That can be upwards of 100 pages on any one issue. Comes to the department, and we get that to the board members before the board meeting. Even after that point, even after that deadline, people are still encouraged to send in written comment up to 10 pages, and they do. They continue to provide written comment throughout the meetings until deliberations are over. There's never a time when the board doesn't accept more information, along with what it's getting in public testimony and in the committees. So this is again another busy slide, but it's one that provides a lot of detail about our local fish and game advisory committees. There are 84 on the books. And at last review, there was 70 plus that were active. A lot of times, advisory committee may not be active when it's in a year where its region's not being impacted. Again, this is all volunteer work, and so people are 900 plus are involved in this process. It's pretty amazing, really, to have this kind of local input. And I recognize advisory committee's frustrations, but they are highly appreciated by the boards. They provide that local voice and that local knowledge that the board members simply don't have. Again, what's especially unique about advisory committees is that the state does provide support for it. So to the extent you've got advisory committees that are made up of a number of communities, the state will help pay for those folks to come together to meet. There's limits on that, of course. But that's especially important in the Western region and the Arctic region, where you do have a number of these advisory committees that are multi-community. And to the extent the advisory committee wants to present in front of the board, then we have funds that will pay for that advisory committee to go there. Just want to leave this up for a moment for the benefit of Representative Millett. Moving on, though, agency input. Obviously, Department of Fish and Game is involved in the process. The Department of Law will sit at the table and serve to advise the board members on all of the legal issues. We have Public Safety that sits at the table. They're there to let us know if a certain regulation is enforceable, if there's complications with that. They provide input to that. We often receive information from the Commercial Fishery Entry Commission. There is a couple of federal organizations that work in and around the board. Of course, the North Pacific Fishery Management Council is the federal counterpart, if you will, to the Board of Fish. They have established what's called a joint protocol committee that gets together as needed to discuss issues of shared concern. And then the Federal Fish and Wildlife Service Office of Subsistence Management will also participate in the board process, and they will sit at the table as well. So there's a number of legal documents and inputs to the board process: Constitution, a couple of international treaties, the Pacific Salmon Treaty and the Yukon River Salmon Treaty come to mind. Those influence board decisions. There's court rulings throughout the years, and of course statutes, regulations, and policies. The boards will often create policies to help govern what it is that they're working on. Constitution, of course, we look at Natural Resources Section, Article 8, Section 4, which speaks to the sustained yield principle. And of course, that is the driver and the cornerstone of the concepts of conservation and development. There's also Article 8, Section 2, which speaks to the maximum benefit for residents, and that influences the board quite a bit. In terms of some of the statutes that the board pays attention to and influences them, of course, their basic authority and the duties that they are to uphold. There's also the powers and duties of the commissioner, and so there's oftentimes the questions about what the board's role is and what the commissioner's role is. We have the Administrative Procedures Act that the board's to follow, and to the extent you would like to get further involved in or see more about the board's process, you'll see that it is I think, the Administrative Procedures Act tenfold. I mean, the things that I read in the Administrative Procedures Act that it's trying to do in terms of protect the public's right to know and give the public the greater voice in all of this, that is the board's process. The Open Meeting Act is critical for the board. They often will create subcommittees, and so that those all need to be noticed through the Open Meetings Act. All the advisory committees, all of their work needs to be noted or followed on the Open Meetings Act. We have court rulings that more recently put a lot of limits to some of the things that advisory committees can do. We have logistical issues based on meeting times, and so it's an important body of law, but it does create some logistics issues for us. And the board, of course, has to meet the Executive Branch Ethics Act. At the beginning of every meeting, they'll provide an ethics disclosure, and what they're chiefly trying to do is identify where they have a financial interest, or perhaps a close family member has a financial interest in some of the proposals in front of them. This last board meeting at Southeast, we had two board members that were having to recuse themselves from deliberations on proposals, which left us with four. And so that was a bit of an extra effort. Well, there's a number of statutes that influence board activities. The first one, I won't go into great detail on all these, but it's the allocation criteria. Whenever, and the way this sort of works practically is, whenever they're involved in vetting a proposal that has an implication that, for instance, affects allocation, the taking and the giving, they need to make sure they cover the concepts and think about the concepts inside this criteria. And so they'll spend time vetting through those and speaking to them, particularly in deliberations. That's the point where you're trying to build a record about making a record for why you're taking the decision you're taking. So you'll see this in board meetings quite a bit for various bodies of law. A little bit about subsistence here and just how it flows for the board. And in fact, I think they may be running this process at our next meeting next week for Kodiak Tanner crab, I believe. It's a small resource there for the board to look at. But they haven't asked these basic questions, and those are, is there a customary traditional use? If the Division of Subsistence, through their support and research, finds that there is, then the board has to ask, is there a harvestable surplus of this resource? If there isn't, then there isn't any consumptive use, subsistence or otherwise. If there is, they'll ask, what is the amount that's reasonable and necessary for subsistence? And this is a survey of what the traditional use has been. And from that, you'll be able to determine what amount goes to subsistence. That gets the first priority. To the extent that there's additional surplus left over, that would go to the other uses, and that's where the board gets involved in its allocative decisions. Similarly, there's a number of regulations and policies that impact the board. Here's a couple of them. One of the things the board does quite a bit is it creates pretty large-scale fisheries management plans, and these things will influence these regulations will influence those management plans. Those management plans are put into regulation and there for managers to follow. So for something like the Sustainable Salmon Fisheries Policy, you know, the board is to think about some of the following concepts: maintaining the resource at a sustainable yield, having fisheries conducted recognizing that yield, establishing management systems that can control and protect the resource, encouraging public support, and above all, managing conservatively in the face of uncertainty. So they're to think about these things and deal with them, and when they make fisheries management plans, help establish these kinds of systems around the resources. I spoke a little bit about mechanisms to bring proposals in out of cycle. Again, in cycle would be the meeting schedule I showed you, the three-year meeting schedule. And so this is, to the extent something comes up that needs to be addressed, there's a couple ways to do that. One is an agenda change request. It's where someone would say, I need you to review this particular issue. The board can do that. If it accepts the agenda change request, it becomes a proposal. Things that it looks at is the action for a conservation purpose. Does it correct an error? Is there an unforeseen effect of a regulation? Is it an allocative issue? They typically won't take up allocative issues out of cycle. They'll steer clear of that. Is there a need to coordinate with federal agencies, programs, and laws? So we'll get agenda change requests in August, and they're vetted at the October work session. So I think the board accepted 8 or 9 this year. So they do bring new things out of cycle. There's also the emergency petition policy. It's pretty important for folks to use. The board will get several of those through the course of a year. And the question they have to ask is there an unforeseen event that threatens a resource? And is there an unforeseen situation that would otherwise preclude biologically allowable resource harvest? So there's just the test the board follows in order to bring these petitions forward for deliberation. There's the ability to bring subsistence proposals in out of cycle. It's to examine fish and game populations not previously considered. I haven't seen those yet, but it's quite possible. Those can come through. And the last measure is a fairly small one. It speaks to whether or not if there's a change in the federal fisheries management plan for Bering Sea, Aleutian Island, King and Tanner crab that the board needs to address. They'd have the ability to bring that forward and deal with that. So last slide is ideas for folks to get involved. We have an active mailing and email list that we continue to send press releases, proposal notices, meeting notices, whatever we have, they'll all receive those. Encourage written comment on all proposals. The proposal itself is a way to really get involved and engaged. Anyone can submit a proposal. Anyone can. We encourage attending at board meetings if possible, and if you can, presenting testimony and joining a local fishing game advisory committee is probably one of the best ways to engage. Just some ideas for folks as they look at the board process. So I think that's what I have for you, Madam Chair.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you describe for me how the Alaska Fish and Game management folks, how they interact with the fish board, what's a common way that there's give and take between those two different bodies?
Well, through the chair, Representative Ortiz, it's mainly at the board meeting. You'll see as they get into a board cycle, they may direct a question or two, specific questions at staff, and they'll want to know about it at a board meeting. So there's some of that. Outside of a board meeting, the chair will engage with the department a little bit more in terms of setting agendas and roadmaps, and actually the proposals themselves. The board chair will is really it's their proposals. It's not the department, so they'll authorize the release of those proposals. In terms of management, though, a lot of it is going to occur at that board meeting. You'll have staff reports in advance, and these are fairly detailed. If you've gone online and looked at them, they're quite extensive and very historical. There's also staff comments, which are highly coveted by a number of people, advisory committees and the board members, to see what staff thinks of each proposal. And then, of course, you'll have oral staff reports at the meetings. And the meetings are quite intense if you haven't been through one. So, there is that give and take at the meeting. It needs to be on the record. I mean, the board members, to the extent they're going to be making a decision, what they base that on needs to be discussed and vetted in front of people. So they conserve a lot of that time for the board meeting. And then as they get into tricky issues, to the extent they're dealing with something that's very intricate, you'll see board members working with the area managers, and there might be a constituent or two at the table talking about their experiences. And so there's that kind of give and take. We had an interesting exchange at this last meeting where there's Trum trollers were looking to extend their ability to catch enhanced chum. And we had some folks from Territorial Sportsmen. So you had personal use or sports fish use and commercial fish at the table, and a board member trying to figure out where exactly they could conduct the fishery to maximize the benefit for the chum troller while not targeting kings. And so you'll see the fishing game manager there to assist as needed. So it's those kinds of exchanges where if I was to answer your question, that's where I see it.
Thank you very much.
Are there any questions? Any other questions from this committee? Mr. Height, we certainly appreciate your time and efforts in coming and making a presentation to us here.
Thank you.
Fisheries Committee, we all know fisheries can be a little contentious every now and then, so we appreciate you educating us on what the Board of Fish does.
Thank you, and I'll follow up, Madam Chair, with questions that we've received.
Thank you. If there's no other questions, then I would like to announce that on Thursday we will have a fisheries meeting to address House Bill 128, Wild Salmon Days. And if there's no further business to come before the committee?
Thursday?
Thursday. Yes. We figured we could do it real quickly because we have session at 10:30. We can come in and it's just for Wild Salmon Days. It'll be at 10.
It'll be wild.
Right. Anyway, I will adjourn the meeting at 10:47. Thank you.